Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. Today's speaker is former Indiana Governor and current Purdue University President, Mitch Daniels.
It is only by happy coincidence that I find myself with the opportunity to introduce today's speaker, a man I can honestly say I've known my entire life. For those of our friends in the audience who are expecting a gridiron-style roast, however, I'm sorry to disappoint you, Eric. And while the people of Indiana are pretty well acquainted with his life history, I've been asked to mention a few highlights. Many of you first became acquainted with Mitch Daniels back in the mid-70s when he was chief of staff for Senator Dick Lugar, or before that when he was a senior strategist for Mayor Dick Lugar. Maybe you also recall that after working for Senator Lugar, he was director of political and intergovernmental affairs for President Ronald Reagan, where, as it happens, he was Haley Barbour's boss. He came home to Indianapolis in 1987 to raise his growing family, and I might point out they are still growing by leaps and bounds, many babies, and to serve as president of the Hudson Institute, which he rescued from a rather precarious financial position and restored to its former position as a national thought leader in this country and the world. Mitch then joined Eli Lilly and Company in 1993, running the North American pharmaceutical operations and serving as a senior management strategist. In 2001, President George W. Bush, with a little help from Al Hubbard, inveigled Mitch to return to Washington to head the Office of Management and Budget, where he served with what my script describes as noteworthy fiscal prudence. His fiscal prudence was, in fact, so noteworthy that the president gave him the nickname The Blade. Returning to Indianapolis, he successfully ran for Indiana's governor in 2004, beginning two terms of exceptional achievement that I can objectively say left our beloved state far better than he found it. Earlier this year, on the very day that his second term expired, he took over the role of president of Purdue University. At Purdue, he's already making a difference, focusing on topics such as university affordability, academic excellence, and the continued relevance of traditional institutions of higher learning. This, in particular, has been a rather exciting week at Purdue, it seems. And we are honored that he'll use this forum to discuss publicly a number of significant initiatives just now being unveiled at Purdue. At least I'm assuming that is what he will be sharing with us. These initiatives are designed to place Purdue among the world's leading academic institutions. It gives me great pleasure to present Purdue President, former governor, and my brother, Mitch Daniels.
So my sis says this is all the result of a happy coincidence.
Happy for me.
Speak for yourself, yeah. I think what she really meant was what's happy is the coincidence between my speaker's fee and her budget for this presentation. I appreciate the chance to be back with you. Congratulations to Ted Boehm and all the others who gave birth to this great forum. Doesn't seem like that long ago, but what a great and esteemed venue it's become over the years. I'm here, obviously, in a different capacity than on previous occasions, but my Purdue friends have heard this. On the day that a year and, two or three months ago, in which Purdue announced its unexplainable lack of judgment. I got an email from a friend in New York City, and his wife is, like him, a very well-known, skilled professional. She's had a fabulous career in the publishing business, knows everybody in the world of books, entertainment, and so forth. Pretty worldly person. He said he went home, and he said, "You hear about Mitch's new job?" She said, "No, what's he going to do?" So he's going to be president of Purdue. She said, "That is just terrible." He said, "Why? I think it sounds pretty cool." She said, "His talents will be totally wasted in the chicken business." So we're going to work on the brand just a little bit. But it's a wonderful place. I'm going to illustrate that in a couple ways before we're done here today, I hope. And I've been made feel most welcome. I'm so excited about the place, its people, and its prospects. I'll tell you a little bit about that. It is different. It is different, just as my last assignment was. There's some veterans of our administration here in the room. They heard me say till they were so tired of it, "We will operate at the speed of business, not the speed of government." I would also say that higher ed operates on a slightly different clock. I was in a meeting yesterday where I was reminded of an old joke I hadn't thought of in years and years, which goes that a turtle is mugged by a gang of snails. And when the police officer gets there, he says, "Who did this to you?" He says, "I don't know, officer. It all happened so fast." So we have different clock speeds, and maybe at Purdue we'll speed ours up a little bit over the course of time. I'm going to use the lazy man's version of a speech and show you some slides. I will move through these as fast as we can. We can get on to your questions, but there are a few facts and figures that I'd like to show you. Now, this being an economic club, I want to talk a little about economics first in a way that I hope you'll find relevant. Now, let me start here. Surely in this erudite audience, most of you recognize this man. No, Jamie, the Jets' new backup quarterback is incorrect. Now, this is Joseph Schumpeter, remembered by economists and students thereof as the original author of the theory of creative destruction, the original person to identify that inexorable process in a free economy in which the new displaces the old, in which innovation drives everything, in which today's incumbent enterprise or product or service is always at risk of somebody inventing something better and displacing them. We like to talk about disruptive technologies as sort of the current buzzword. Dr. Schumpeter is the one who figured this all out, and among many memorable statements says, "Capitalism never, of its essence, can never be stationary." And we can all think of all kinds of examples. The blacksmith probably never imagined how quickly he would go out of business. Those of us who grew up with Polaroid cameras or just most other kinds of cameras have seen them go away. Whoever thought the record store, the music store would disappear, but they have. Just this week we saw the Dow Jones Index, just a small version of this, but farewell, Alcoa, Motorola, and Bank of America. In comes Nike, Visa, and Goldman, I guess it was. No one is safe in a competitive process, and thank goodness for it. This is where progress comes from. This is where the wealth of millions comes from. But it is not a process that does not cause trouble, particularly for incumbents. Here's another way of looking at it. So if you go, you can roll the clock back as anywhere you want. Arbitrarily, I did here to the mid-50s. If you look at the Fortune 500, this shows how long it took for half of them to disappear from that list. And so half of them were gone in 25 years. If you came on in 55, 25 years later, you had a 1 in 2 chance of still being up there. Please notice that over the years, this is all speeding up. It only took half as long for the class of 95, for half of them to get the boot with some new, stronger, faster-growing business. A lot of people, and I'm one of them, worry about newspapers these days. Look at the plummet in newspaper circulation. By the way, this is over a 40-year period, 50 years almost, in which the population, available customers, all went up 50% or more. And so the newspapers in particular, it has occurred to a number of people, are an interesting parallel to the enterprise in which I now find myself employed, of higher education. And we think about what Schumpeter had to say, that in a society like ours, enterprises cannot be stationary. It's hard to think of anything much more stationary than higher ed has been. It doesn't look a lot different than it did in medieval days, or hasn't until recently. And so people have rather suddenly, just really in the last few years, began asking questions about higher education that no one ever asked before, and here's just a sampling. But the system, and it has been by any measure, an enormous strength for this country, a competitive edge for the United States. We've got to find ways to make sure that continues. But it's under challenge, and I don't have to spend much time here. Many of you have either asked these questions as observers, parents, board members, trustees, something, or just as interested citizens. People inside higher ed are finally waking up and are worried about it. This data appeared just the other day. At least 3 out of 8 people with jobs like mine are really worried about the enrollments at their schools, and that's up a long way. Fewer students enrolled last year than the year before, not the first decline, but the first one of that size in a long time. And despite all that, the cost of doing all this is still going up. The rate has moderated a little bit, but still much faster than anything else you'll find, including health care. People are asking, is this system really teaching what society needs most? So here we have engineers on the top, scientific degrees on the bottom, China leaving us way in the dust, the U.S. stagnant at best in producing those people who increasingly drive economic progress and growth in a highly technological world. People looking more closely than they used to are asking, are students really learning? What are they doing while they're there? And a study and a book that caused a lot of consternation, it's hardly the only one to raise this question, but it's probably a little better documented than most, found that almost half the students in the schools they study, no one could demonstrate any gain in critical learning, writing skills, and other tools of citizenship and economic contribution among the students who had spent time and a lot of money in those places. A lot of businesses are starting to say, what's a diploma mean? And how do I sort out when everybody shows up with straight A's, how do I know who really is the best of the best? This is the phenomenon known as grade inflation. Private schools on the top, public schools below, and an average in between. But in the years since many in this audience were in school, it's gotten a lot easier to get a good grade. I'll tell you about an outlier to that phenomenon in a little bit. People are using some interesting metaphors to talk about higher ed these days, like bubbles. People are asking, why isn't this the next bubble? A rapid increase in prices, lots of money borrowed to support it, possibly not the substance, the return necessary to support those levels of borrowing. So here's the cost increases that I talked about. Overall CPI on the bottom, we all know about medical care, for instance, and energy, higher tuition and fees, runaway increases above all that. Moody's, for the first time, rated the whole sector of higher ed negatively in its most recent rating. And you see, to me, an interesting quote from an economic standpoint, the pricing power is nearly exhausted. You would all like to be in businesses that have had the pricing power that higher ed's had, which is to say, not only has it appeared for, 20 years or so, you could raise tuition as fast and as far as you felt you wanted to, but you almost got a bonus for it. I know there's an economic term for it. My wife calls it the Tiffany's effect. If it costs more, it must be better. That sticker price game has been running free in higher ed for a long time. Some people, I'm one, think it's run its course. You all know, you've all heard, some of you maybe have direct exposure, perhaps as subsidizers, I don't know, to student debt. Student loans now over $1 trillion, more than auto loans, more than all the credit card debt put together. You've seen all these figures. And incidentally, sermon for another Sunday, the next gigantic exposure to the federal government, the U.S. federal taxpayers, that nobody's been counting up to this point, because the federal government's on the hook for now much of this, and a record percentage of it is not only delinquent, but, as they say, seriously so. And so that brings us to the stay-up-at-night issue for somebody with a job like mine, which I can loosely characterize as the pajamas test. What is it that the universities of today can do to make sure that in 10 years or 15 or maybe sooner, they are unquestionably offering an education and an educational value that will continue to persuade talented young people to leave their homes, move somewhere for 4 years, and spend a whole lot or more, and spend a whole lot of money to do it, when all around them people are saying, we can get you the same thing for a whole lot less money? The modern technology, talk about disruptive technology, online education, experiments in it are everywhere right now. Some maybe will fizzle out, others are more promising, but no question, this is the sort of disruptive technological threat that businesses face all the time and that Dr. Schumpeter was telling us about way back when. It may be apocryphal, although I got a friend who swears he was there to see it, that one of the great gurus, I won't name him, in American high tech, was invited to speak to a group of university professors. And he came out on the stage, you know, black turtleneck, very dramatic, and said, now the first thing I want to tell you is, the problem in American higher education is, we're not paying the faculty enough money. Big round of applause. No, no, I'm talking a lot more money. Hey! So the best professors in America should be paid at least $1 million apiece. They're tearing the walls down. He says, now, I'm only going to need about 100 of you. So the metaphors are piling up. Bubbles, the president of Stanford very quotably called it a tsunami. As he said, a tsunami's coming. I just got the latest study yesterday, Larry Summers, I can't remember who else is all in it. It's an avalanche. Everybody's saying pretty much the same thing, which is, you know, look out. And these, I could show you these all afternoon. These are just a smattering of the kinds of comments and forecasts. Hundreds of universities in bankruptcy, historic shakeout, et cetera, et cetera. Don't know. Could well be overdrawn. I hope it is. Again, I'll say our universities in particular, our great research universities, are a priceless asset for this country. And if they are not currently well suited to the demands of the day, then let's go find out what changes might make them so. As we have taken to saying at Purdue, it is no ordinary time. I'm not in the chicken business, but I am not in a business for chickens. Now, let me tell you a little bit about what one university plans to do or try to do about this. Before I do, let me just not take for granted that you know all you might about our land-grant university, Purdue University. So here we are, about 30,000 undergrads, close to 40,000 counting graduate students. We have favorable ratios of faculty and tenured faculty teaching students. We can always do better. $600 to $700 million in research spending last year. The profile of our entering freshmen is going up and up and up. We are capturing the lion's share of the best young talent in Indiana. I had a slide showing that the average Purdue entering freshman SAT is 20 points higher than that at IU, but I thought it'd be bad manners to show it, so I won't. There are only a few schools in the country that require 4 years of math. Tell your high schoolers or junior high schoolers, for two reasons, keep studying math. One is it may be necessary to get into the finest schools. I would think more schools will move to this requirement. The second is The data is very clear. Nothing more surely correlates to long-term success, no matter what you're studying, than 4 years of high school math. Jay, I think, Jamie. My predecessors at Purdue saw this and applied that, and that's one reason we are that our freshman profile keeps going up. I talked about grade inflation. I love this. I found this when I was doing, let's say, due diligence on whether to accept this job. I thought this was such a positive thing. This shows the average grade rising over the years. And the pattern is very clear. It's school after school after school, average grade just drifted up and up and up, which is one reason why a lot of businesses say, how do we know who's really good if everybody shows up with 3.x? Down there near the x-axis, you will see a little gold data point. That's Purdue University. It's just about as hard, any of you Boilermakers in the audience, it's just about as hard to get a good grade now as it was at Purdue 35 years ago. I said to the freshmen on my two opportunities so far, you know a lot of good reasons to come to this school. You may know another one is you have come to a tough school. Congratulations. When you get out of here with a good grade average, people are going to know you earned it, that you studied something hard to get there. I do want to say I put a red oval around IU. They're not doing too bad either, and I congratulate them for it. It doesn't matter who ranks them. When people rank the quality of our graduates out of school, how well are employers pleased with the graduates of various schools? What are our graduates earning compared to the tuition that they paid? What do recruiters say and so forth? Purdue grads are at or near the top of all those rankings. So we have a great platform, but we believe that the questions that are being asked and the challenges and the threats to higher ed as we've known it are very real, and that they encourage us to try to keep moving forward and make a great school greater if we can. So let me just run you quickly through announcements we have made this week about the next steps that we think will make of Purdue a winner in what might be a time of shakeout. They come in really three buckets with an underlying theme. The buckets are leadership in STEM. We often say, so that's science, technology, engineering, math. We often say STEAM because agriculture, at which we are very good, is a very, very high-tech business these days. Research. I am staggered by the brilliance all over the Purdue campus of the researchers we have, and we've got to do a lot better job. We've launched a whole series of initiatives to improve our tech transfer, the opportunity to commercialize and bring into society more of the talent, more of the products of that research. But despite the breadth of the quality there, we've taken a really hard look at the inventory, and we've picked a couple areas. You can't do everything in business or anywhere else. If you're trying to do everything, it's a formula for going nowhere on anything important. And so we have picked a couple areas for special emphasis. The way in which education is delivered in higher ed, if it's not going to be people sitting at home in their pajamas eating Cheetos, then very few people think it'll look the same as it always has since the first Don put on his first funny hat at Oxford 1,000 years ago. The cliche is the sage on the stage, you know. So what do we know about that? What are we going to do about that? And underlying all this, a different view about what education ought to cost and how it ought to be offered and promoted to those who would come after it. Think of this a little bit as a matter of business strategy. It's not about business with us, it's about our mission, but you could think of it this way, in a matter of positioning. When you array the universities of the country, the major research universities, from most to least, let's say STEM-centric, so on the left, those that have the highest percentage right now of their undergraduates studying in one of the STEM disciplines, on down to the least. We are already well to the high end. You have Georgia Tech, a little gap to UC San Diego, then comes Purdue, and then there's a gap to everybody else. If we are successful in the expansions and that we have just embarked upon, we will move further to left. We really will be there as one of maybe two clearly defined outstanding STEM or universities in the country. Just to point something out to you, IU is down at the other end, which I consider a really a positive thing. This state is so blessed to have two Big Ten universities. There are only 6.7 million of us, remember. And if you were, you can just do the mental math, if you were to average our STEM percentage with IU, you'd wind up right in the middle of this spectrum. So there's a choice for every, there's an excellent choice for every student. And I'm not even mentioning all the other great universities, some of which are here in the room. Three things that we will do, among others. These are the three big ones. We are already expanding our College of Engineering. We're in the second year of a five-year plan, very bold. Along with the trustees, we've already said to that college, begin planning for 2.0. We're going to go even further. And when we have, we'll have more than 8,000 undergrads and thousands of graduate students studying engineering at Purdue. A recent national commission said that America needs at least 10,000 more engineers per year. When we're done with this, we will have added 1,000 or more, and we will have, you could say, contributed 10% of the national solution. I'm excited about doing it. We're going to try to transform our current College of Technology into something, the working title is a Polytechnic Institute, but the employers in the room, many of them have said to us over the course of time, and many students have said, they'd be interested in studying in a different way. And so some of the features they're talking about here are design lab courses every year, every student with at least one off-campus learning experience, every student with at least one work or internship experience during their 4 years, the entire senior year devoted to a project-based, possibly industry-sponsored, team-oriented work. We think there'll be huge demand from some students who would like to become technology proficient that way, and we think there'll be huge demand from businesses who want people ready to step into mid-level and project team leadership right away. And finally, we're going to grow our computer science school, currently between 700 and 800 students at a time, to over 1,000. So here's the expansion of engineering. 107 new net faculty will have to replace some, so we'll be hiring a lot of engineering faculty in the next few years. This is before 2.0 starts. This is computer science, about a 27% increase in the number of students that we hope to produce there. Here are the research areas we've selected. Drug discovery, where Purdue has at the present moment 36 drugs, as John Lechleiter would say, in man or in clinical trials. And at more than any other school we know about, we're going to go out to hire some all-stars and augment the people we already have. We have great new facilities just about to open. We hope that we can really be a center at a time in which the industry, I think John will confirm this, is struggling with productivity of research and quite often more interested than before in partnering with research-based academic institutions. And plant science, Purdue's won two of the Nobel Prize, so to speak, of agriculture awards in the last few years, feeding a world that's going to have 9 billion people in it off the same or perhaps no more land is going to require incredible scientific breakthroughs in higher yielding plants and in plants that are resistant to drought and pests and plants that can grow in soils where currently we're not very successful. We don't think anybody can beat us to that if we make the right investments and add the right people. How are we going to teach? We have some real experts, one of them sitting right here to my right about this subject, but maybe the right way to say it is nobody right now is a real expert. All we know is that new ways of learning are coming and coming fast. We have already transformed 63 courses at Purdue from the method most in this room would recognize, two lectures, maybe a lab, two lectures and a discussion, into courses in which quite often you never attend a lecture. You watch it in your room, or you watch it on your handheld, and you watch it as often as you want. You can back up over the parts you didn't understand the first time. When you go to the course, to class, it looks very, very different. You're in a discussion of the points you'd struggled with. You're doing exercises or practical applications of what you learned. The professor knows something probably because you've answered some interactive questions, knows what you're struggling with and zooms in on that. We're going to double the rate at which we transform those courses. We don't know of another university that's even close to 63. And a year or two from now, we'll have two or three times that many. One thing we are not doing very well right now, we don't have nearly as many students as we'd like studying internationally. You probably know Purdue is about the most international campus in the country. If you come up to our campus this afternoon, 1 in 10 undergrads you will meet is Chinese. 1 in 6 is international. It's a rich, cosmopolitan environment. But ironically, fewer of our domestic students are studying over abroad than should. We're going to double that. We're going to try to raise significantly the percentage of students living on campus, not just because it'll maybe improve the ambiance a little bit, but because students who live on campuses, ours, IU's, anywhere's, do better. I'll show you in a second. And we're going to try to use our campus much more aggressively in the summer, much more of a year-round university, possibly all the way to a trimester system if the student demand can be built. I'm just guessing here, but I don't think too many businesses in this audience shut down for 2.5 months in the summer and let their capacity sit idle. So here's what classes will more look like. Here's the significant differential in grade point average and retention rates for students who live on campus as opposed to living off. Now, finally, we're going to try to do all this with a different outlook toward the cost of education. We're going to absent ourselves from the sticker price wars. We froze tuition this year. You may have noticed, first time in 36 years. When I learned how expensive the food is, by the way, people say, what's the biggest surprise, you know, going to this new world? I go, the food. You can't believe what these kids are eating. College food's supposed to be terrible. It's unbelievably good, but maybe we might have overshot a little bit, or maybe we can provide it a little differently. So I asked them, see what you could do with 5% lower costs, and guess what? They made it without too much trouble. This is just an example. In the best of all cases, with frozen tuition, a student paying tuition and eating food in our dining halls and a part of our co-op program, which is a work-study program, which we also cut the cost of, is attending Purdue right now for $900 less than he or she would have a year ago. And there aren't too many schools that can say that. So that is not a one-time gesture. That will be an ongoing quest. We'll have to see how well we can do with it. Like your businesses, there are costs that are out of our control in some ways. But we're just very determined to ultimately deliver exactly what you do. And whatever your enterprise is, ultimately, you're only successful if you deliver value. And as simple and obvious as this seems, raise quality, control the price or the cost, stretch that ratio as far as possible, and you'll win with your customers. And that's where we're headed at Purdue University. We are so proud of the mission that we have for this state. We're so determined to be a place that a student from any income level can attend and get the highest quality education anywhere on the planet and go out and succeed for life in our state or elsewhere. And we will welcome your support in the things we try to do here. We'll welcome your ideas about things we haven't thought of yet. And we will continue to try to be the asset for this state that you expect and that we intend to be. Thanks so very much.
Thank you. And now, as a reminder, please use the white cards on your table if you have a question for Mitch or tweet us at @economicclubin. I haven't learned how to read those yet, but someone will bring me the tweets. You talked about the pajama test, and you said that, you know, the guy is sitting there eating the Cheetos, and it's a lot easier to get an education that way. But you are trying to expand residential living, you know, on-campus living. How do you think that'll work, and why?
Well, again, it'll only work if people see additional value beyond what someone is offering elsewhere, and so we'll find out. We think that there are elements of a current Purdue education that are plainly not available in a purely online environment. I'm talking about research. More than half of our undergrads are engaged in at least one research project while they're there. Talking about team-based and project-based learning. It's pretty hard to do, sitting out alone at home. If we're successful in finding these new ways of teaching that I was talking about, we ought to be able to deliver substantially more learning, substantially more growth than is possible, at least with today's online technologies. Now, we're entering the online world ourselves. A lot of the courses our students are taking now are online. And we've got some announcements coming soon about expansion of that. But we still believe that if we're smart about it, there are ways in which a residential education can bring dimensions that just aren't possible. I want to say one other thing. Something else that has to come to higher ed, Jamie and his colleagues are leaders in this respect too, is more accountability. People want to know. Prove it to us. If you're charging us all this money, how do we know? And we're going to accept the responsibility to do that. Right before I came down here, I dropped in on a faculty task force that I put in motion on my first day on the job and said, I know this isn't easy. Nobody's really got the great answer yet, but somebody has got to begin testing their students or otherwise validating that a smart student who came to us with that high SAT I showed you actually grew and grew as much as all those thousands of dollars of tuition should be expected to pay for.
Here's a question. I'm more familiar with the A in STEAM as arts, a known catalyst for critical thinking, problem solving, and writing. Your thoughts?
Well, liberal arts are real important at Purdue. I argue as important as they have ever been. I tell our engineering students all the time, you're going to live in a world that is more technologically driven than any we've known. But it will not be enough to be a brilliant scientist or engineer if you can't, first of all, see for yourself the context. If you don't know any economics, if you haven't thought about the social implications of the change that your technology will provide, you won't really be the citizen we're out to produce. And if you can't communicate about it to other people to whom these things are very confusing and people who aren't as far up the scientific curve as you are, then we haven't done our job. So liberal arts, extremely important. In this week, when we announced our intention to get even better, reinforce our strength in STEM, I was also just so thrilled to announce the biggest donation in Purdue history to a liberal arts college for the endowment of two new chairs in history. One's going to be at the choice of the department. One's going to be in the history of science. One's going to be in the history of medicine. So these are ways in which we think our assignment, our land-grant assignment, remember, 150 years ago almost, was to be a place to produce productive citizens, and they said then, agriculture and the mechanical arts. That's what we were put there for. Well, today, it's morphed. What we think the mechanical arts in an information age are a little different, but we still think we're pursuing that mission, and we got our cousins down the street in Bloomington who are the world's best in so many areas of liberal arts. I think that as citizens, you can be really comfortable that we have the whole toolbox here, and any student can find just the right place to take advantage of it.
There are a couple of similar questions, and let me give you both of them.
They're not about football, are they?
Not yet.
Not ready to answer,
those questions are over here. What do you consider the right balance between teaching and research, and do you think you've got the right balance at Purdue? There's a sort of similar mm-hmm. question, a little bit. As you and John Licklider well know, drug discovery is an extremely difficult and expensive endeavor. Is the university a proper venue for such a risky and expensive undertaking?
Yeah, two great questions. Well, the first one is I think, a hardy perennial. It's been asked a long time, and the answer may change a little over time, but you won't find a great teacher at Purdue. I can't find one, and I've met hundreds now, who doesn't say that the research they do makes them a better teacher. And quite often they say that it also works the other way. So do we have the balance just right? Our faculty are teaching at a higher percentage than in many other places, if not most. And that's one thing to keep an eye on. We've also got some faculty who are so brilliant and perhaps on the verge, for instance, of discovering that next great cancer therapy, that it's probably the right thing in selected cases to have them concentrate on research, maybe all the time, at least for a time. So I don't think there's a straightforward answer. There's not one answer that fits everywhere. But, you know, we've only got a certain number of research universities in this country. And again, business R&D has been dialing down, or business direct involvement with R&D is, in too many cases, is flattening. And so finding a way to maintain the activity or increase the activity at our best research universities is real important. Drug discovery, good question. But a lot of what we do, I hope, will be done in partnership. Maybe we can share some of that cost and risk. For the moment, we still have large amounts of money that that as federal taxpayers you are providing through the NIH and elsewhere. We think we can compete very successfully for those with the new competencies, the new people that we're out to bring. But no question about the risk, but what we also know is the reward in terms of longer, higher quality lives for millions. There's just very few areas where success brings more good.
There are a few questions about high school students and how you interest them in STEM. Mm-hmm. How can the business community in particular encourage young junior high and high school students in STEM? How can a young adult in high school avail himself of college credits before college?
Yeah. Well, a lot of good things going on here. I appreciate that question very much. You know, next, it's going to say Tuesday or Wednesday, I'll be in front with the U.S. Secretary of Education and another former governor that he invited. He invited the three of us to talk to the business roundtable. So this is the CEOs of the 100 biggest companies by sales, as I recall, in the country. And that's my assignment. What can they do to help promote more interest in STEM and also more preparation for the rigor of a physics, a chemistry, a computer science, an engineering curriculum at a school like ours. So there are some great things now going on that reach all the way down into the elementary grades. There's some great things that involve technology that make it fun for a young person to work on. But thanks to whoever for that question. Thanks to any of you who are working on that.
Again, a couple of similar questions. How do you reconcile the argument that everyone should have a college education with the desire to enroll only the best? And do you agree with PayPal founder Peter Thiel, who said that too many kids go to college?
Yeah. Well, I don't think everybody should go to college, but I think everybody should finish high school and go on to something after high school. And it really probably should not be the colleges, at least as we have known them, and as their shortcomings in some cases I've just illustrated for you here. But a really important goal for people in this state is that everyone pursue education beyond a quality secondary education, and in many cases that means a college as 4 years as we've known it. So I celebrate the growth and the work that's going on at Ivy Tech. Has to be part of the answer. We've got, as I recall, 750,000 Hoosiers. That's a big number in a state of fewer than 7 million, who did some post-secondary work and never finished. And a great opportunity there. And maybe you remember a little, an outfit called WGU that we sort of brought and private labeled here as WGU Indiana. Picked up thousands of those people already. All these things need to be worked on. Now, you know, Peter Thiel's the guy, you know, a little bit of grandstanding, who gave some super smart kids $1 million. Instead of going to college, go out and invent the next Google. Well, I hope they do, but that's not an answer. How many such people will there ever be? And how many people will the most successful of them ever employ? So, you know, he can do with his millions what he wants to do, but that's not an answer for a state like ours.
A couple of questions about the regional campuses. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little about the role of those satellite campuses and the discussions about closing some of them?
Well, I'm not for closing, at least the ones we're operating. My thinking, by the way, I've learned so much in the last year or so. My thinking's changed on a lot of questions. This is one. I wasn't really sure about the regionals that we're involved with. We have two in the northwest part of the state, and we have Fort Wayne in IPFW in partnership with IU. Of course, we're the subordinate partner here at IUPUI. And there are issues. There plainly are issues. The graduation rates in those places are way too low. Way too many students have gone and tried and not succeeded and probably not come away even with enough incremental gain to justify what happened. But we cannot give up on that. If you go visit those places, you will be as moved as I have been to see people holding down two and three jobs and doing whatever it takes to try to attain a college degree, single parents and so forth. Young people who simply cannot afford, no matter how long we freeze tuition, they're going to need to live at home at least for a while. And we have to have places for those citizens, and we have to get better at what we're doing. So I'm a big defender of those. All you got to do is come with me to one of those commencements and see the variety of people and the brave people of different kinds coming across there, tears in their eyes to get that diploma they may have worked years for. And you'll, I think, agree that let's go make them better, but we're not giving up.
We have people who want to know, we're one of the nation's greatest exporters of educated talent. How do we keep these fabulous Purdue graduates in Indiana to benefit our economic development? This sounds like a governor question. And what are you doing to keep more of those foreign students in the U.S.?
Yeah. Well, you know, great question, of course. First of all, you should know we are keeping more of them, a lot more of them. I haven't seen, the last year I saw was 2011, but in that year, and I hope this was not a one-time blip, but the Education Roundtable received the data somewhere back there last year that Indiana had become a net importer of college graduates. And we all pay close attention when one of our sons or daughters or some friend's sons or daughter gets a degree and then gets a job somewhere else. We don't tend to notice when Exact Target hires 300 of them in 1 month, you know, or some business that grew here brings them in. Lilly's been bringing brilliant people into this state for 100 and X years. So the answer has always been about economic opportunity. I ran for the last job, something I didn't expect to do. If somebody said, what are you doing this for? I could always distill it to one sentence. I'm tired of seeing our best kids go somewhere else. And from talking to, by now, thousands and thousands of them, I can tell you, almost nobody leaves this state because they hate it here. Oh, I just got to live somewhere else. I don't like, you know, I don't like the people. I don't, you know. No, they have left over the decades because our economy wasn't strong enough and diverse enough to offer them the chance to realize their ambitions. We are gaining on it. The life sciences developments are real, and they're getting significant. Nobody saw it coming, but the explosion in software, particularly marketing-oriented software, we're a national capital of that just in the last few years. You know, if we make the right moves as a state, or I would say keep making them, this issue begins to really take on a positive reinforcement. And one great capture brings the next, brings the next. Everybody in this room has seen that happen somewhere, I'm sure. Last thing, I'm with that group that says when we graduate from IU or Ball State or our place, when somebody walks across the stage and gets a diploma, somebody from another country, we ought to put a green card in there with it and just say, you know, America wants you. If if you're willing to stay with us, and a lot of our students do, I wish it was more.
Okay, in 30 seconds or less, two brief questions. What do you think of your LA Dodgers chances in the upcoming playoffs, and will Purdue cover the spread at the Notre Dame game on Saturday?
Well, the hell with covering the spread, we're going to win, and that one's easy. And the all I can tell you about the Dodgers is if they should figure this out, they should buy me a ticket out of the country every year, every time, because I went to China on Purdue business on June like 21st, which was rock bottom, and they barely lost the game for the next 2 months, you know. And if word gets out to L.A., Magic Johnson should just send me a plane ticket, like, get me out of here, and they'll go all the way. Thanks an awful lot.
Thanks so much, Mitch, for taking the time to speak with us today and to share your vision for the future of Purdue and the LA Dodgers. Today's presentation will be broadcast on WFYI Public Radio 90.1 FM on Monday, October 7th at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and is also available for download at WFYI.org. Please join us next month on Monday, October 28th, for a presentation from Gary Doerr, Ambassador of Canada to the United States. Ambassador Doerr is recognized as a proponent of balanced budgets, a leader in alternative energy and energy security, and an environmental champion. He promises to be an intriguing speaker. So please be sure to purchase your tickets today to be part of this event. Information and tickets for each of this season's presenters can be found at economicclubofindiana.com. Thanks, and have a wonderful afternoon.
Broadcast of the Economic Club Speaker Series on 90.1 is made possible by the Lumina Foundation, with a goal to increase the percentage of Americans with high-quality degrees and credentials to 60% by the year 2025. Focused on ensuring an accessible, responsive, and accountable higher education system. You've been listening to Purdue University President Mitch Daniels. Today's broadcast can be found at WFYI.org. For information about upcoming speakers, visit economicclubofindiana.com. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. Thank you for joining us. I'm Erin Masterson.